It's the morning show. I'm Shereen Seward, in for Kate Archer-Kent. The national opioid epidemic accounts for the majority of the more than 100,000 drug overdose deaths recorded in the United States last year, largely due to fentanyl. Earlier this month, health officials in Wisconsin issued an advisory asking the public to take action, noting that fentanyl overdose deaths in Wisconsin nearly doubled from 2019 to 2021. Join in this discussion on what can be done to combat this ongoing problem, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Paul Krupski is Director of Opioid Initiatives for the State Department of Health Services. Paul, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me back. Appreciate it.
The State Department of Health Services says more than 90% of opioid overdose deaths and almost 75% of all drug overdose deaths last year involved synthetic opioids like fentanyl. Why is this happening? What's behind this sharp increase in fentanyl-related overdoses?
Actually, this has been a trend that we've seen over the past several years, and it just continues to increase. The numbers that you just mentioned, which is our provisional data for 2021, is the highest that we've seen yet. And this is a national trend, not just in Wisconsin. And really the main factor behind this is that fentanyl has just become prevalent throughout the entire drug supply. It doesn't matter the substance that we're talking about. It could be heroin, it could be cocaine, other stimulants like methamphetamine, obviously the counterfeit prescription pills that are being manufactured now and seen widely across the United States. Fentanyl is being found in all of these. And so the fact that fentanyl is so potent is leading to the fact that there are more overdoses and deaths occurring. Individuals that maybe have never used an opioid in their life, maybe have no interest in even using an opioid, they don't realize that the substance they are using, that they're consuming, is laced with a synthetic opioid, again, likely fentanyl, and the potency of it is what's leading to this increase that we're seeing in overdoses and deaths across the country and also in Wisconsin.
So it sounds like there are instances in which people are consuming this without realizing that what they're taking is laced in fentanyl. Is that what you're finding?
Absolutely. And that's why, education and awareness is more important than ever. And that really led to why the Department of Health Services put out this public health advisory a few weeks ago, because of the numbers that we're seeing. The number of overdoses and deaths related to fentanyl, as I mentioned, have continued to increase over the past several years. And we need people to be aware that it is being found across the entire drug supply. That we really wanted to couple that public health advisory with the fact that August 21st was the first fentanyl prevention and awareness day across this country. So we did a lot of media. The Department of Health Services did a lot of media over the week period with the public health advisory leading up to that day and then into the following week. And we just need to make people again aware of what could be in the substance that they're using.
Where is the fentanyl found in Wisconsin coming from? Do we know what the source is?
Well, I think that it's coming from multiple places. It definitely continues to come, from overseas in China and throughout Asia that makes its way into this country. And then my understanding from talking with law enforcement officials and also, other federal government agencies is that it's now coming up through Mexico more than before. Mm-hmm. So definitely coming, multiple ways into this country, making its way throughout the country, and that's why we're seeing it nationwide.
And I also want to touch on something that you mentioned briefly just a moment ago. You talked about the potency. How much more potent is fentanyl compared to, other drugs?
Yeah, so the potency of fentanyl is off the, or synthetic, any synthetic opioid for that matter, is just off the charts compared to, compared to other substances, and can be 100 times, if not more, more potent than other drugs. So when you add that into, the substance itself, again, whether that be, heroin or cocaine, the danger that poses and the possibility for an overdose or death from the individuals who are using it just skyrockets. And you know, it can be just if you're able to visualize it, it can be as small as a couple of grains of salt that can really increase the possibility for overdose and death if fentanyl is in it. And again, that's why we need people to be aware that it could be it could be in any substance that they're using. And what we want people to know is that there are steps that you can take to help and prevent these overdoses and deaths that we're seeing across our state.
That strikes me, small as a couple of grains of salt. We're talking about the sharp uptick in fentanyl-related overdose deaths with Paul Krupski, who oversees opioid initiatives at the State Health Department. Fentanyl overdose deaths in Wisconsin nearly doubled from 2019 to 2021. Paul, where is fentanyl abuse growing the most around the state? Are we seeing this more in urban areas, or do you have a sense of that?
I think the important thing to know is that, you know, just going back to the start of the opioid epidemic, when we really, as a country, realized what was happening in the mid to late 2000s, this is a national thing, and this is a statewide issue as well. It doesn't matter where you live in Wisconsin, opioids are an issue, and we are seeing overdoses and deaths take place across the entire state. Now, that being said, you know, obviously we do see higher counts and numbers in our more urban areas. But when we look at rates, which is a better way of looking at the data, again, it's very across the entire state and very representative in certain populations as well. Our Native American population in the state has the highest amount of opioid-related overdose deaths, followed by our Black or African American communities. So it really crosses all populations and races, all counties, all regions of the state. And again, just why it's so important to make sure that we're getting the word out and people are aware of this fentanyl.
In recent years, we saw a significant rise in the use of heroin. And I'm curious about the correlation there. How did the rise in heroin use or other street drugs affect the rise of fentanyl?
Well, you know, I think that fentanyl really came into play for, a couple of reasons. One is that it is extremely cheap. And so individuals that manufacture or distribute illicit drugs, they can purchase it, for a very low cost. And then in the end, they make a higher profit margin in selling that. The other issue is that because of the potency of it, it creates a new high or a new type of euphoria that an individual who is using substances may not have experienced before. So it again can just kind of take that reliance or that addiction to a new level, and individuals then like the way that they feel, and then search out that substance for future use.
I saw something on NBC News that said once users start using fentanyl, it's really tough to go back to using heroin because they don't get that same high that they're used to. The Milwaukee County's medical examiner office said roughly 4 out of cocaine-related deaths now involve fentanyl. Why is fentanyl often involved in cocaine-related overdoses? Is that a surprise?
No, it's not. Unfortunately, it's not a surprise at all. Again, because we are seeing fentanyl being found across the entire drug supply. And, we have seen cocaine deaths involving synthetic opioids rise significantly. Just back in 2016, across Wisconsin, there were 39 deaths that involved cocaine and a synthetic opioid. In our provisional data for 2021, we have seen 426 deaths with cocaine and also involving a synthetic opioid. So it's just an astronomic rise. And again, I think that really goes back to the fact that fentanyl is across the entire drug supply right now. Individuals that are using a substance, other substances like cocaine in this example, are unaware that fentanyl or another synthetic opioid is present, and then they are overdosing or unfortunately losing their life because of that.
Paul Krupski directs opioid initiatives for the State Department of Health Services. Join in this discussion, 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Shereen Seward. We continue our discussion on the ongoing opioid epidemic in Wisconsin amid a documented rise in overdose deaths attributed to fentanyl. Join in on what public health officials are doing to address the problem and the role of law enforcement. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. The State Health Department's Director of Opioid Initiatives is Paul Krupski. He stays with us for 10 more minutes. Paul, given the increase in overdoses involving multiple drugs, do you think that the public health approach should change in any way to help reducing these overdoses?
Well, the opioid epidemic is definitely very complicated, and it is an evolving problem, an evolving issue. And, I think what's most important is that it requires a cooperative effort between all partners, organizations, and communities across the state. I do believe that the comprehensive approach that we've taken at the Department of Health Services, going back 7, 8 years now, is the right approach. And I look to data that we saw pre-pandemic, which showed that we saw the first significant decrease in opioid-related deaths in Wisconsin in over 2 decades. We had seen multiple years of opioid-related hospitalizations on the decline. Unfortunately, as we know, the pandemic really threw everything into a tailspin and put many challenges, obviously, on this country. And the challenges around the opioid epidemic, we're obviously involved in that as well, too. And that's why nationally we've seen increases. But I do believe if we stay that course, if we stay that path, we will again turn the tide on the opioid epidemic. And what that involves is really investing across the continuum of care. We need to be investing in prevention strategies, harm reduction, treatment, and recovery. We know that comprehensive approach, making sure that all those services are available, is how we're ultimately going to turn the tide and see less opioid-related deaths in the state.
A recent study looked at non-fatal overdoses involving both methamphetamine and opioid use. And the research found that 17% of people using meth alone reported having overdose reversal medications available to combat that, to reverse the overdose. Should that be more widely used, in your opinion?
We want naloxone to be in the hands of anybody and everybody who wants it. That's our goal. And specifically with what the Department of Health Services tries to provide in communities across the state is Narcan, which is the nasal version of naloxone. And again, because of the prevalence of fentanyl across the entire drug supply, we do encourage anybody who is using substances to have Narcan on hand, not use alone, and make sure that the other person you're with knows how to administer Narcan should you experience an overdose.
There's a new drug that's emerging called xylazine. It's becoming more common in urban areas in the U.S., and we see that local usage has really jumped in recent years. 4 deaths in Milwaukee County in 2020, 32 deaths as of July 24th this year. What do you know about that drug? Tell us about that.
Yeah, so xylazine, again, I think just to start my response with, this is the fact that the opioid epidemic continues to evolve and just drug use across this country continues to evolve. And we need to make sure that we are adapting to that, that we're aware of what's happening and that we're able to respond to it. And the xylazine example that you give is a great one. It's definitely being seen all across the country. As you note, we are seeing it in Wisconsin, not just in the Milwaukee area, but other places as well. And it is not an opioid. Its actual use is as an animal tranquilizer. And the scary part is that since it's not an opioid, it's not responsive to naloxone. But that being said, we still encourage everybody to have naloxone on hand. Narcan, obviously, again, the nasal version, the one that our department works to get out statewide, because we are seeing xylazine mixed in with opioids. And so it's better to respond in some form or fashion to save a life and try and reverse the overdose that's being experienced. But xylazine is another example of something that we need to make sure we are getting education out around the state so that people know that they need to be aware of it and that, again, it could be mixed into the substance that they are using.
We're talking about drug overdoses in Wisconsin with Paul Krupski, who oversees opioid initiatives at the State Health Department. I want to talk a little bit about prosecution of these drug-related crimes. Reporting overdoses kind of feels like a little bit of a legal gray area. Drug users calling for help for other users. They've been jailed as a result. One Milwaukee criminal defense attorney, Deja Vishni, and others have criticized how people are charged when they call in an overdose. What is your response to that? What do you think?
Yeah, you know, we definitely want to encourage individuals to call 911, even if they have Narcan and are able to administer that on the individual for an overdose, and make sure that first responders are alerted and they can come to the scene to make sure the person is safe, or if they need to revive the person and get them the appropriate medical attention that they need. We do have a Good Samaritan law in Wisconsin that is for individuals who do call to notify of an overdose, and individuals should be aware that that exists so that they can not be prosecuted for making the call and making them aware of that. That being said, there is the possibility that they could be prosecuted for other crimes at that time as well. But we really want to encourage individuals to know that there is a Good Samaritan law, that they can reach out to first responders, call 911 if an overdose is taking place. And we really want to do that because that's a number one way that we can save lives.
We have Bill with us on the phone from the UP in Michigan. Hi, Bill. Thanks for calling.
Oh, hi. Thank you so very much. Very powerful, interesting topic.
Well, I think that we have lost Bill. Hopefully we can get him back. Our producers did note that he was mentioning that this cuts a lot of people off with chronic pain. Then they go to the streets to get opioids, and then they're laced with fentanyl. How do you perceive that as contributing to the problem?
Well, it's definitely an issue that we need to make sure our prescribers in the medical community know how to address. And that is why both at the federal level and also at the state level, we have opioid prescribing guidelines. And in those guidelines, prescribers in the medical community are given guidance on how to best treat individuals with chronic pain to make sure that they are prescribing them appropriately, that they are not cutting them off in need of treatment for chronic pain and pain relief, and so that they are not turning to illicit substances or other street drugs to address their pain. So we do have definitely prescriber education strategies and projects that are used throughout the state, and that is how we address that issue to make sure that that the medical community has all the information available to them to know how to address chronic pain.
We have a little over a minute left together. What approaches are other states taking that are fighting these rising fentanyl overdoses? Is there anything that's working that Wisconsin can learn from?
Well, I think the main tool that we are really looking forward to using more widely here in Wisconsin is fentanyl test strips. Fentanyl test strips are a harm reduction strategy that allows individuals to test their substance to find out if fentanyl is present, and then if so, to then make other safe decisions onto whether to use the drugs or not. Like with many other states, fentanyl test strips were illegal in the state of Wisconsin, and just this past March they were decriminalized. The legislature passed legislation, and Governor Evers signed Act 180, which decriminalized fentanyl test strips. So we're in the process at DHS right now of putting together a program to where we can distribute fentanyl test strips far and wide to community organizations and agencies, and they can get them out in the communities into the hands of people that need it. And we feel that it's just a great tool for individuals to know if fentanyl is present, mm-hmm. and then to make decisions on whether to use the drugs or not.
Paul, thank you so much for sharing this important information with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Paul Krupski is director of opioid initiatives for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Up ahead, we talk about the expansion of the Big Ten with UW-Madison Athletic Director Chris McIntosh. Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. News Update is next on the Ideas Network. Show. I'm Shereen Seward in for Kate Archer-Kent. The Wisconsin Badgers football team enters the 2022 season this weekend with the hopes of winning their first Big Ten West title since 2019. Wisconsin football comes into the season ranked as the number 18 team in the AP preseason poll. Do they have what it takes to go all the way? Join in this discussion on the season ahead and Wisconsin Badger athletics in general. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Chris McIntosh is athletic director for UW-Madison. Chris, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Shereen. It's great to be here.
USC and UCLA in Los Angeles are joining the big conference in 2024. What do the moves mean for UW-Madison?
Well, I think it's a good position for UW-Madison and certainly the Big Ten. You know, it's indicative of a changing landscape across college athletics. It would have been impossible a short time ago to envision an opportunity like the one that we were presented with. Two great schools academically and athletically, a lot of history and tradition. But I think, you know, it marks a turning of the times for college athletics. And it's a great opportunity for our conference and in turn for UW-Madison. I think it's a great opportunity for our student athletes. They're excited about it. It's a great, two great schools to compete against. But, you know, the ripple effects of that decision across college athletics, I think, are yet to be felt in its entirety.
The moves add two West Coast schools to a conference that is otherwise based out of the Midwest and the Northeast. Do you see geography mattering for conferences at all anymore? It used to. What about now?
Well, I think, I mean, your point raises a good one. I think it used to be very important, and that's where conferences were largely born out of. I think I'd go back to, you know, this idea that the landscape of college athletics is just being redefined right now. And so, you know, the Big Ten as a coast-to-coast conference positions it in a strong way, for sure. It does come with challenges. Obviously, geographically and logistically, operationally, there are challenges. And I think we're working through those now at the conference level in terms of trying to schedule in a more intelligent way and coordinate in a more intelligent way. But I think, you know, as a regional conference, I think, you know, those days are past now and we're seeing a lot of dominoes falling.
One of the challenges involved must be the travel time. The NCAA limits students to a maximum of 20 hours per week of athletic activities, and that rule excludes travel time. What's the risk of more travel time affecting students' academic life, especially, you know, it takes a few hours to fly from Madison to Los Angeles, for example.
It does. I mean, I think that is a challenge. I think, you know, one of the aspects of the student athlete experience that's overlooked, though, in this part of the conversation is the fact that, you know, for many of our athletes, if you take, for example, our women's softball team, you know, just in terms of our climate here in Madison, Wisconsin, and the idea of playing a spring sport, in this example, softball in April, per se, you know, that team, by way of example, has a lot of time on the road right now. They need to seek warmer weather and a more friendly climate to play softball. And so they're spending a lot of time in a normal year in areas like Arizona. And so I think there's a way for us to direct that what's already existed towards a conference opponent, or a conference colleague in SC or or UCLA. And so some of those things will align naturally.
We're talking about UW Athletics with Chris McIntosh. He's athletic director at UW-Madison. We have a caller. It is Dino from Wausau. Welcome, Dino.
Yeah, hey, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, thanks for doing this, Director McIntosh. So I was hoping I could talk about Title X and how we elevate female athletes for a second. So our family are women's hockey super fans. And to use an example from that, Daryl Watts is the number two all-time point scorer in the NCAA. And she won a national title for us. She won a Patty Kazmaier Award. And by any objective measure, she's a once-in-a-generational talent. And I'm wondering what an athletic director can do to elevate these women to ensure that they get the recognition that they deserve.
Thanks, Dino. Chris, what do you think about that? I mean, could you do more? Could the university do more to ensure that these women who are outstanding athletes get a little bit more recognition for what they're doing?
Yeah, Dino, it's a great question. You know, this is we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of Title IX this year, and I think it speaks to for us here at the University of Wisconsin a commitment to broad-based opportunity. We have 23 varsity programs, and you know what you're referring to is, I think, an extension of that. How do we showcase the amazing accomplishments of, you know, some of the most talented young people, in this case, young women, within our program? And this comes up in a variety of ways through more than a few of our programs. Women's hockey is a great example. There's been a lot of talk about women's volleyball, and Coach Sheffield has been very vocal recently about media coverage of our women's volleyball program, and as a way to showcase, these examples of just first class, best in class representatives of a university like ours. And so, I think we continue to push forward and to try to through our media partnerships with the Big Ten, try to find ways to showcase those competitions, but also those stories. It's been one of the ways that the Big Ten Network has played a role. We're fortunate in that our conference has its own TV network and can share stories that exist, you know, in this case, off the ice, and profile our student athletes, in this case, women. But I think, you know, the celebration that we've been enjoying over the last year has been more than a celebration. It's called attention to the fact that we need to continue to push. We need to continue to advance at this time when college athletics is redefining itself. We need to continue to advocate for broad-based opportunity so that, you know, in our case, 800 student athletes can, you know, pursue their athletic passions and dreams, but also at the same time obtain a degree from a world-class institution like ours.
Big Ten this month signed a new 7-year contract with TV networks Fox, CBS, and NBC. This deal essentially cuts out ABC and ESPN, which previously aired the games. Is this a good decision? And what will it mean for your programs?
Well, I think it'll mean a few things. To the point we're just discussing that Dino brought up, I think it will bring with it the opportunity to showcase additional sports, Olympic sports, in a way that we haven't been able to. Technology through media has advanced, and part of our new media partnership will allow for more inventory availability and therefore more coverage of stories like the ones we're talking about right now. But in a more general sense, we're really excited about our new media partners. It will obviously provide a spotlight for our student athletes to showcase their abilities, both, you know, within competition and outside of. It goes without saying, it'll provide resources that we can then in turn use to support our mission, support our student athletes, and also, you know, build some significant capital projects around campus. And so, not to mention support, you know, an academic award incentive that we're now able to provide, which allows us to provide a financial incentive for academic achievement. That comes at a price tag of, as it ramps up, almost $4 million a year.
I'm curious about your use of social media like YouTube and others to promote sports. How does that play into your strategy when you are working to gain recognition for all of your athletic programs?
Well, I think, you know, internally here within our own staff, it's interesting to, you know, pause and look back on just the emergence of how media is used to promote our program. It wasn't long ago that, you know, video here within our program was limited to, you know, use of practice and game footage for our sports. And now video is probably our most effective content producing marketing tool for our program to showcase our, not only our sport programs, but our student athletes and the, and their experience here on campus. You know, we've used a program called The Camp to highlight kind of personal interest stories, but also our football camp here throughout the month of August. It's been very well received. And, you know, that's something that just a few years ago we couldn't have imagined.
Do you think, too, that that adding those new teams to the Big Ten will wind up with, you know, give kind of a boost to the overall program exposure-wise?
I think it will. You know, I clearly, you know, USC and UCLA, you know, reside in an enormous media market. You know, there are a high concentration of Big Ten alums in the LA market, much less Wisconsin alums. I think that's a great opportunity for our fans it's a more convenient opportunity for them to get exposure to the conference and to Wisconsin. And, you know, I think, you know, just the nature or stature of those two programs creates the opportunity for big, memorable moments, competitions, you know, travel for our teams, you know, for our team to go to out and play UCLA in the Rose Bowl. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a big opportunity. I can just speak from my own experience as a student athlete to be able to set foot in that historic arena, or stadium rather, and play a game is something that can't be minimized.
We will talk about the upcoming Badger football season in just a moment, I promise. Chris McIntosh is athletic director for UW-Madison. You can join in too. 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. The Morning Show. I'm Shereen Seward. It's been over a year since UW-Madison named a new athletic director. Many people are eagerly anticipating the start of a new Wisconsin Badger football season, which kicks off this weekend. Join in this discussion on expectations for the team and the leadership challenges involved. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Chris McIntosh is athletic director for UW-Madison. He stays with us. Badger football opens this Saturday in Camp Randall against Illinois State. Chris, the American Football Coaches Association ranks Wisconsin 20th in the nation. AP poll puts the Badgers at number 18. What are you most excited about?
Well, I think I'm most excited about, you know, our team taking the field and playing in front of, a full house of Badger fans. You know, it's as we round out the last week of camp last week and now this week, game week, and focus on our opponent, Illinois State, you know, to be able to run into Camp Randall and to hear the support of the best fans in the country, it's a reward, and it's part of what it it's part of, you know, playing on a big program like ours. You know, when our team takes the field this year, Camp Randall will look a little different. South End Zone Project will make its debut. The field will have a different name attached to it, Barry Alvarez Field at Camp Randall. And so those will mark, you know, significant changes. But I think, you know, one of the things that hasn't changed, and I don't expect to anytime soon, will be, you know, the support of our fans and the approach that our team takes, our players in particular, to, you know, matching up against an opponent.
There is a sort of magic at Camp Randall, isn't there? I mean, when you're there and you're in the middle of it, it's just it's a different feeling than going to just about any other stadium. And I have to wonder how your players react to the home field and in the feeling that the fan base and hearing them. How fired up do they get when they run out onto that field?
Yeah, I mean, you raise a great point. It's a complete emotional reaction when you wear our uniform, put your helmet on and run out of that tunnel, and you're greeted by, you know, almost 80,000 people that are just the best in college football. And the venue itself is special, and the history, it's, you know, Camp Randall is over 100 years old, and there's so many memories and moments here. But you know, all those things are made up by the people that were here, and Camp Randall is a great venue, but it's the fans that fill it that make it special, and it's the players that take the field that make it special. And I think it, you know, if you talk to any of our players present or in the past, they'll tell you just how emotional it is to run out of that tunnel in Camp Randall.
We're talking about UW Athletics with Chris McIntosh, Athletic Director at UW-Madison. Chris, what are you hearing about how the team is coming together? Are things clicking? What do you expect to see this season?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'll leave the specifics to Coach Chris, but I would tell you this. I've had a chance to watch a number of practices and be around this team and these kids, and I'm as excited as anybody is about this season. I think we've got an incredible group of young men on this team. There's a lot of talent all around this program right now. And it'll come in the form of, you know, some names and faces that our fans will be very familiar with. And maybe, you know, what's even more exciting is, you know, some of the new faces and the new names that our fans will get to know. And so, I would tell you, this particular team, just from my viewpoint, has as much or more talented as just about any team we've ever had. But you know, football is a funny game in that it takes more than talent to win the game, and I think, you know, chemistry and teamwork and playing smart are kind of been, you know, just kind of foundational principles of our program. And I look forward to our current team and our current kids upholding those.
The Board of Regents capital budget request for the next legislative session includes plans to demolish the Camp Randall Sports Center and replace it with a nearly $300 million new indoor football practice area. Why does Badger football want this new training facility? Why does it matter?
That's a great question. I think, you know, first and foremost, it's important to clarify, this is a program. This is a project that will serve more than just Badger football, and so it is an indoor practice facility, and it will house a football field, much in the same way that our current structure does in the McLean Center. But, you know, consistent with that, you know, we use the McLean Center for a variety of sports in addition to football, and so it's an important program. This is an important project for all of our programs. It's a big one. It's, you know, might be unprecedented in its stature. But, you know, right now, the Shell building, which is adjacent to Camp Randall, is in its last years. The McLean Center, which was built in the 80s, consists of an 80-yard field. And we've just found ourselves in the bottom three or four programs within the Big Ten in terms of modern day indoor practice facilities. And it's become just a glaring need that we need to address.
You have plenty of experience in athletics, but you became athletic director for UW-Madison just over a year ago, July 2021. What's it been like? What has been perhaps an unexpected challenge of the job?
Well, you know, it's been a great year. We've had a lot of successes over the last year. I think, you know, one aspect of the last year that would have been impossible to anticipate is just the pace of change in college athletics. You know, from a Supreme Court decision last June in the Alston case, permissibility of name, image, and likeness last July, conference realignment across the country, all kinds of issues, you know, down to it, you know, change in leadership at our own university, from Chancellor Blank to now Chancellor Mnookin. So I think it would have been impossible to have predicted just how much change would have taken place over the course of a year, and we anticipate will continue to. That has brought with it, you know, great opportunity. I'm really proud of our staff and of our student athletes to be able to try to seize some of that opportunity. You know, one of the kind of core beliefs we've had here for a long, long time, under this foundational principle under Coach Alvarez as a coach and then as athletic director, is to embrace change. And I think we've done a good job of doing that in a way that's consistent with, you know, the Wisconsin way, doing it with a high degree of integrity. And you know, that I expect will continue, but would have been impossible to have predicted.
Just very briefly, in the last 20 seconds we have left, what is the new definition of college athletics going to be? You talk a little bit about how it's changed. What is that new definition to you?
Well, I'll answer your question this way. You know, what has to be part of the definition is education and broad-based opportunity. And so, you know, we are advocating that education not be lost in the conversation about college athletics, nor can opportunity for us over 800 young, talented student athletes.
Chris, thank you so much for joining us and sharing this with us today. Best of luck to you.
Thanks, Shereen.
Chris McIntosh, the athletic director for UW-Madison. I'm Shereen Seewert. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. We'll be right back.